Hey there, spooky friends, and welcome to another episode of the Scariest Podcast.
Woo!
I'm Robin Grace, this is Adam Diaz, and we're here with a couple more topics. I'm really excited to hear Adam's this week because I have no idea what he has in store. This week, I'm going to be a little different, and by a little different, I mean I'm going to cover something similar to what Adam covered last week.
Yeah, you told me little bit about your topic, and it definitely sounds super interesting. What are you going to be calling your topic this week? I think I'm
going to start a new series. It's going to be called Lost and Found.
Okay.
And it's people that have disappeared and been found again.
Okay. So this is the good Lost and Found, where there's something in there worth, you know, your time, not like the bad Lost and Found where it's like a wallet with no cash in it and a used condom, which is obviously something that no one wants to claim.
What Lost and Found are you digging through?
I mean, just the junk drawers, you know, since I've been going through stuff in the house recently. So,
why do you have those in your drawers?
Mementos.
That's disgusting.
All right. Before this gets any weirder, I'm going to go ahead and say that I'm going to be covering the Lost Cabin Mine this week, which I'm pretty excited for because I had a really specific idea of what I wanted to look for as far as like a broad topic. And I found something that was like, kind of, you know, hitting the nail on the head. So I'm excited for that. So I'll get into more details when it's my turn. Robin, for the last 7 days, the folks haven't heard from us. What have you been up to? How's life been? What's up? What's new? What's cracking? What's popping?
Nothing new. I'm just living my life, doing stuff, making content, posting videos of our dog.
Right on. Those videos are made by me, sent to Robin to show how cute our dog is. And then she posts them on her Instagram. So people must think you have very manly hands, which I think is hilarious.
I do have very manly hands, TBH.
Right on. So that's fun. I drove out to see Robin on Saturday. I flew back on Sunday. And then I took my dad to a surgery on Monday morning. So I was pretty pooped for around 3 days, but it was totally worth it. My dad is recovering well. And it was nice to see Robin. So that was pretty cool. And then today I worked and, you know, now we're doing the show. So there you go. You have been caught up on the lives of your scariest hosts. Pretty
nice,
fun
nice,
stuff.
Nice.
So do you want to go ahead and just jump into our topics?
Yeah, why not? Let's just do that. Yeah, you go first.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and dive into my topic. And this week I really wanted to cover a mystery or a true crime or something along those lines from the Wild West. Because although I haven't been watching Wild West movies, I've definitely been thinking about having like a little movie marathon. Like I've been thinking about rewatching like The Quick and the Dead, which is this movie from the 90s. It's a remake, obviously, and it's not that great. Or The Gunslinger with Gregory Peck, or 310 to Yuma, the old one or the new one, or both. The Proposition, which has Guy Pearce, or Tombstone, which is just such an amazing movie. And, you know, there's tons of Westerns out there that you could pick up and watch if you ever want to get into that genre. And of course, I'd probably wrap it up with A Million Ways to Die in the West because it's so funny. It's just so silly. It's a great way to, like, if you're just deciding to bounce off the genre, like, that's a good one to have, like, wrap things up for you.
It's on HBO, so I watched it, like, 2 nights ago.
It was on. I finished my topic before Robin, so I was like, I probably have, like, 30 minutes or so. So I went downstairs, let the dogs out, and it was on the TV because I had left it on an HBO channel for the dogs to watch a movie or something. And A Million Ways to Die in the West was on after I had written this script, and I was like, how apropos. So with that in mind, you know, I really wanted to focus on a topic from the Wild West. So I wound up finding one that I think you folks are going to enjoy. It is very true crime. It has some elements of mystery. It definitely has death. It has some hauntings, some whispers of a curse. So without further ado, I present to you the Lost Cabin Mine. So
I'm living for this one. You have me. You're pulling me in.
Okay.
Tell me about it.
Here we go. Get your ear holes ready. So the thing about the Wild West that I think a lot of people don't realize or just simply forget is that there is a reason in this day and age that the Wild West, that phrase, is a euphemism for chaos or lawlessness. Like, these places were towns that were built by folks headed out that way and had, in nearly all cases, that had little to absolutely no law enforcement. It's like they made these towns that were supposed to be like temporary posts. Some of them became permanent. Some of them were like set up to become permanent, like Tombstone, where they wanted it to not be a mining town. They wanted it to be a place like San Francisco. But there wasn't like any federal oversight. There certainly wasn't any state oversight at the time because there weren't any states yet. So there was no law. Like, it was just lawlessness. People would just show up and you just do whatever the fuck you want and whatever you could get away with. And
I mean, that's what they put forth in Wild Wild West. Anything can happen.
I hate you so much. She mentioned that movie and I just like that movie is such a pile of garbage.
We've talked about it before on the show. I love that movie.
You know what? I get everyone has movies that they like from their childhood and they have nostalgia. And nostalgia blinders are a very powerful thing. But Wild Wild West is not one of those things that has nostalgia effect on me. I think, you know, when I was younger, I was like, this movie sucks. And now as an adult, I'm like, oof, what a steaming turd. So we definitely disagree on that. But when it comes to the case of the real Wild West, in lots of cases, when there was law enforcement, like a sheriff or whatever the case may be, those law enforcement folks looked the other way for most of the crimes that took place because they didn't want to get involved with a lot of shit because it could mean their life. Like the idea in the Wild West of a quote unquote fair fight was basically if both parties were armed and they had an opportunity to draw their weapons. So regardless of who got killed, it was considered fair if basically it wasn't an attempted assassination. If you didn't just walk up and shoot someone and they didn't have a chance to shoot you back. If they had a chance to shoot you back, it's a fair fight. And most fair fights were spectacles. Like people used to literally challenge other folks to gunfights in the fucking street. And people would go watch. That's not just like a scene from a movie. Like that's shit that happened. Like two people get into a fight. They'd be like, you want to settle this outside? And settling outside didn't mean fisticuffs. It meant if you have a gun on you and I have a gun on me, one of us is about to die. And that's like the law in the Wild West. And that's how things actually were. Like they would have gunfights until someone quit. Like, okay, I'm done. You win. Or it would be to the death, which was the case most of the time. So that's what we talk about when we talk about the Wild West. Like, a lot of the mindset behind needing to be armed to prevent something awful from happening to you, especially when it comes to the western part of the United States, is a derivative of the shit that took place for like 100 years in the Wild West. It's literally called wild for a reason. So it's not shocking that things that people would do in the Wild West would be kind of heinous. Like they'd be trying to make a quick buck or just take advantage of other people because they could. No one was there to stop them. Or in some cases, try and strike it rich. And it should be mentioned that this land that people were going out and doing this shit on, it already belonged to other people. All these folks venturing west were literally stepping foot onto land that had been settled by for hundreds of years and thousands of years in some cases, Native Americans. So the tensions were quite high. People were not, you know, in the best of spirits considering how lawless it was and considering they weren't necessarily welcome. They just sort of showed up. And most of the folks that were going out there, they weren't going out there for the lawlessness. Like not everyone was Doc fucking Holliday. They weren't going out there for the gambling and the titties. They were out there for one specific thing. Like the thing that drove people west was gold. People wanted to find gold. There was gold in Dim Hills, and gold meant riches and fortune. You just had to go and find it.
All I can think about now is the titties.
That's all anyone ever thinks about. So this attracted more folks than just those who had already settled in America. It's not like people in America were the only ones that knew that there was a gold rush happening in the United States. It attracted anyone who heard of it, and that shit will make its way across the ocean, you know, after a short period of time. As soon as someone says like, oh, someone found a fortune in the West in the United States, then they're like, oh, fuck this, I'm going to go look. So in 1865, a group of 7 men from Sweden decided they were going to try their hand at prospecting in the American West, and they headed out to do it. They were said to have been based for a time in the Black Hills of the Dakota Territory before pushing further west in search of their fortune. They traveled for weeks with horses and carriages, taking all of their equipment with them. The journey was very treacherous. When I picture people heading west, I absolutely picture the old Oregon Trail game, like hunting animals, people getting dysentery, having to choose to pay the ferry to cross the river, or just floating your wagon and being like, let's hope no one dies, which they always do. So one night, this particular group, they stopped to camp near a creek. Usually when you stop to camp, you want to stop to camp near a water source because you want to have something to eat, preferably, and then clean water to drink. So that night, they were going to decide what to do next on their journey because up to this point, it had been several weeks, they had had zero luck. And provisions could only hold them out for so long. Like, even if they were going to hunt for their food, they would eventually run out of bullets or arrows or lasers or whatever the fuck they had in their inventory. I really never used the cheat codes on Oregon Trail, so I can't tell you anything outside of, like, bullets. But okay. Anyways, one of the chores when making camp is to have someone go gather water. Like, hey, go find the water source that we went by. Get us some water while we set up the camp. And you usually want to do that before the sun sets because you don't want to have to, like, search in new territory in the dark. You don't want to get hurt. You certainly don't want to get lost on your way back to camp. But it was late. The night had already taken hold. And one of the men was like, fuck it. I'm going to go to get water. The moon's out. I should be able to find it pretty easily. The creek that he went to get water from is now known as Badwater Creek. It's a real place. This is a real story. And as he was filling his bucket, he noticed that the sand, the dirt beneath the water, was glittering in the moonlight. And he scooped up a handful of that dirt. He let the water run over his hand. And when the dirt was gone, he saw nuggets of gold sitting in his palm.
Oh, snap. Shiny nugs.
He called out to his partners and he said, I don't speak Swedish, but I imagine it was whatever this translates to in Swedish. Holy fucking shitballs. And so his partners all came running. He showed them the gold and they're like, that's real gold. And they came. They were super excited. They went and got their equipment and they panned the creek through the night. And they talked about what they're going to do for the next day. And after hauling in quite a bit of flakes, quite a bit of nuggets, they decided we need to sleep. And when we wake up, we need to find the vein. Because for those unfamiliar with ore in mountains, it typically exists in long, thick strands or clumps that run through the rock, similar to the way your veins run through your skin. So that's the best way I can put it without getting too okay. geological on you, is that if there's an ore that exists within the rock, it sort of like spreads its way through. And because there was so much in this creek, they're like, the vein has to be close. Let's find that vein. So flakes and clumps float downstream, and usually a vein is exposed due to the erosion that water causes, and that's why people will pan in like moving water to look for stuff like this. But if you want to strike it rich, like if you really want to be rich, you don't want to just pan for this shit in the water. You want to find the vein, and you want to mine that vein. So the next day, they wake up, they go looking, and they find it. They find upriver a portion of the riverbed that had collapsed. And as it collapsed, it exposed the vein of gold and also flooded this creek with nuggets and gold flakes because it's just debris that just came off when it collapsed, you know?
I'm wondering, like, how gold is embedded in rock. Like, how does that happen? How does this mineral just create itself there?
I can tell you for sure, I don't know. It's just there magically. Okay. That's all I know. I'm pretty sure lightning strikes a rock and it creates gold that just goes all the way down to the center of the earth where like the mole people are. So
nice.
Pretty sure that's how it goes. So there was a major problem. I mean, this is a great thing. They just found this giant, massive vein of gold, but there was a problem. Winter was coming. It was bearing down on them. They knew it. The nights were already super fucking cold. So
what are they going to do? The Night King is going to be here soon.
I hate you so much. It's not the long winter. Everyone knows that hasn't come yet. So they put their efforts into finding this vein. They find it and they're like, hey, we need to build a cabin so that we don't die. Like the camp that we had set up was temporary, but we need a cabin. And there's a debate that happens amongst these seven gentlemen about what they want to do. Do we, one, build a large cabin and stay in this area and amass a stockpile over a long stretch of time, or do we build a smaller cabin that's more temporary, but get as much as we can, so put up a small cabin super quick, get as much as we can, as fast as we can, and get the fuck out of here. Because they were, after all, on territory that wasn't fucking theirs. This is not their place. This has not been taken over yet by the, you know, settlers or whatever the nice name is for the people that came and stole all this fucking land from the Native Americans. They were on Native American land when they found this vein of fucking gold. So they decide, let's build a small cabin because we don't want to get caught unawares. Let's get as much as we can over the course of a few days and let's get the fuck out of Dodge.
It's like how to make yourself visible. Make a fucking cabin. Right? Are they idiots?
Also, the phrase, get out of Dodge. I don't know if you guys realize this. That's a Wild West reference as well. Dodge City is an actual city where some crazy shit went down. So the phrase get out of Dodge derived from people wanting to leave Dodge City because it was a place where fucking crazy shit was happening. Side note, if you didn't know Dodge City, that's where Wyatt Earp got famous. Like, he was famous for a lot of things, but that was one of the first big ones where everyone like knew who the fuck Wyatt Earp was. So
is that where the brand got its name too?
Dodge? Maybe. I don't know. I thought it was the name of the family for some reason, but who knows? I thought it was like, that's what you need to do if you see the car coming at you is Dodge. So they're like, let's call our car.
Oh,
that.
God.
Anyways, 2 days pass. These guys mine the shit out of this vein, get as much gold as they possibly can, working tirelessly. And they are focused on nothing else. They put this cabin up super quick, start mining it. They take shifts. They're barely sleeping. They don't see anything happening around them. They're not focusing on the winter coming in. They're just trying to get as much gold as possible. They are so obsessed with doing this, they don't even notice that the Native Americans spotted them when they arrived and started building this cabin.
Of course they did.
The Native Americans that spotted them were like, there's seven of them. We should probably call for backup. And they did. Oh. So the Native Americans that were considered backup show up on the day these seven dudes who are taking this gold are set to leave. And they don't notice it at all. They are working to try and get this gold out of this vein. And the Native Americans attack. When they attack, these dudes had no defenses whatsoever. It's not that they didn't come prepared to defend themselves. It's that all they were doing at that time was mining. So at the onset of the attack, four of the seven are killed immediately, just dead. In the chaos of the attack, three of the men managed to flee. They just say, like, fuck it, grab what you can. Let's get the hell out of here. They run away. And they hide. Like, they just decide, like, we need to hide and hope they don't find us.
They know that they're up against Native Americans who live off the land, right? They're going to hunt them. Like, you can't.
Like, it's 1865, so there's this, like, really negative mindset around Native Americans. Like, they were thought of as, like, savages or primitives. And it's like, okay, cool. They've been living here. I have a story later in my script that talks about, like, thousands of years ago when Native Americans were still on these lands. And it's like, they still thought they had the advantage for some reason. And they're like, oh, fuck, we don't. We need to run away and hide. So they leave. They're like, maybe we can get away. Maybe we can hide and they won't find us. It takes less than a day for the Native Americans to find the three survivors and they attack them again. But this time, they knew they were being hunted. They straight up knew there were Native Americans out there who were looking for them because they were on their fucking land. They were armed. They were ready for the attack. And it said that, quote, many Native Americans were killed in the second attack, end quote.
Oh, no.
It sounds like this was like these guys had firearms. Well, the Native Americans did not. But during this second battle, one of the three survivors is badly wounded and the other two grab him and they run and they hide in a cave. It's kind of like to hide and to seek shelter because it's getting cold. So that night, the wounded man was wounded mortally and he succumbs to his injuries. The Native Americans are searching for these dudes and they realize they're probably hiding in the caves. They go and check the caves. They don't find the men, but they find their horses. And they basically just say, like, hey, these guys don't have shit. They don't know the land. The winter's about to hit. Just take the horses and just leave them because they're going to die one way or the other. They're going to starve to death or they're going to freeze to death. That's going to happen. And they say, fuck it. Like, we're leaving them. And they leave these two guys behind.
That's pretty brutal.
Yeah. I mean, they knew that, you know, the land was basically going to take these dudes. And at that point, they felt like they had driven them off of this particular vein of gold. They didn't really have much interest in mining this and selling it for whatever purposes. Like, it's not really what they did. They just didn't want people to take shit off their land. So these two guys realized they stole our fucking horses. And if we want to get back to civilization, we're going to have to walk in the winter. And so they decide we're going to sleep during the day and hide. When the sun goes down, we're going to try and walk as far as we can until the sun comes up. And that's what they do. They start hiking back east, traveling at night, hiding during the day. They walk for 2 weeks. They're nearly starved to death.
2 weeks?
Winter has set in. They've barely eaten anything, just what they could catch. And they arrive at Fort Reno, the biggest little fort in the world. And the commanding officer there, when they get there, he's like, who the fuck are these guys that are in terrible shape? And they are so fucked up, they can't even communicate to this commanding officer, like, oh, we're prospectors. Like, we went out to get gold. We got attacked by Native Americans. No, they can't see anything. So the commanding officer decides these fucking dudes must be deserters.
Oh, no.
Throw them in jail. So they do. They fucking throw them in jail and they take their belongings and shit. And they decide, like, okay, put them on trial. And during the trial, they go through their shit. They realize their identities. They're like, oh, these guys are prospectors. They're citizens. They're not soldiers. We can't hold them. And they basically get discharged. They're like, okay, well, we're going to escort you to Fort Laramie. So just go with, like, this detail of soldiers. They get taken to Fort Laramie, which is in Wyoming. And when they get to Fort Laramie, they're like, hey, we have some gold we would like to deposit. And it's split up between, like, the bank, the post office, and one other spot in Fort Laramie. And they basically have a bag with them when they say, like, hey, we have some gold we'd like to deposit. And they're like, okay, how much? And they show about $7,000 worth of gold in 1865. So if you want to know what that equates
to, that's insane.
Imagine spending 48 to 72 hours just working really hard and mining gold and shit and coming out with around $130,000 worth of gold. That's what they were able to grab and run away with. There's supposed to be a bunch more that they mined that's back at that cabin that they left behind. So one of the survivors, one of the last two, is super disoriented. He's incoherent. They basically just chalk him up to being mentally ill. And the other one who's coherent tells people the story of what happened, that they built this cabin. They found this vein of gold in the mountains to the west. It is located in what is now Oregon. And he just basically tells folks, like, yeah, that's where we got the gold from. That's why we're super fucked up, is because we had to run away. And after some time, people are like, oh, shit, like, we believe this dude because he has a fuck ton of gold. So
is it worth it if your friends die, though?
I mean, at this point, they're like, we've sacrificed so much, you know, and we know where this vein is. This one guy is basically just like, I know where this vein is. There's a fuck ton of gold back there. And the vein is still there. And over the course of the winter, he convinces 11 people. He has a party of 12. Let's go back there and get that gold. And he has a newfound fortune, so he can finance this expedition himself. So they go back in May of 1866. This one survivor who was coherent and 11 other dudes, they're like, we're going to go get that fucking gold. BRB. And they leave. And they are never seen or heard from again.
Because the Native Americans killed them.
They absolutely disappeared. Everyone's like, okay, cool, we'll see you later. And they never fucking come back. Later accounts from Native Americans in the area state that there was a battle with a small party of people who were coming to try and claim this gold again. And they did, in fact, kill all of them. So the story of this lost cabin mine becomes particularly popular. It's been popular, in fact, for over 150 years, but especially during the time when people are looking to strike it rich. It's very hard to find gold in mountains. When someone says, we found gold, here it is, I can tell you where it is, there's just people there protecting it. There was more of a drive to try and go find a guaranteed payday than to go search through the mountains for, like, you know, endless amounts of time to try and find another, you know, vein of gold.
And they didn't map it out or anything?
I mean, they had an idea, but there's only one dude left at this point, you know? Like, there's one of them left. There's a general story about where this place is, but for the most part, like, they knew the trail they went through, and then they got attacked, and they had to fucking leave everything behind except for, like, a bag of gold they took and, like, whatever they could take to survive.
All right.
So there's a famous mountain man named Jim Bridger. Some of you might have heard of him if you're, like, into Old West shit. Jim Bridger was really famous in his day. Not quite Elon Musk, but, like, probably like Bear Grylls style shit, okay? So people knew who Jim Bridger was, and Jim Bridger hears this story. Jim Bridger's like, well, fuck, man, like, let's go get it. Let's not take 12. Let's take 120 dudes, and let's go get that fucking gold. So this happens in the 1870s, 1880s. Jim Bridger dies in the late 1880s. So he decides he's going to get this big expedition together. They're going to go to this fucking lost cabin mine. And he's like, you know who we need to get us there? So we need that batshit crazy dude who's been there. So they go and they get the last remaining survivor who's incoherent. And they're like, you're going to come with and you're going to get us there. And they set out. And when they set out, the survivor, who's fucking crazy, keeps taunting all the men in the expedition, telling them, you're never going to find this treasure. This treasure is cursed. This gold vein It is cursed. You will never get it. And he tells him, and if you find it, every single one of you is gonna fucking die.
I just imagine him singing that song where it's like, never gonna get it, never gonna get it.
That's actually where the song comes from.
Oh, so now yeah, you know. Got it.
Yeah. And he refuses to lead this guy. These guys know the story. They know the whereabouts of where this is supposed to be. But he fucking flat out says, like, I'm not taking you there. Fuck you. Like, he's not going to do it. He probably didn't even want to go in the first place, but he was kind of coerced into going. And he pisses this expedition off so much, these dudes want him dead. And they set up a noose to hang him. And Jim Bridger comes out. He's like, you can't hang this guy. He didn't do anything wrong. We all knew there was something wrong with him. We made him come. And he's probably the best chance we have of finding this thing. So Jim Bridger convinces these guys, like, don't kill him. But he still taunts them. And they continue on with their expedition, and they start getting close. They start picking out landmarks. They're like, I think we're getting close to this gold mine. But slowly but surely, some people are, you know, abandoning the expedition. At least that's what they think at first.
Oh, because, no, like, they're getting plucked off. They go from 120
to 119 to 118. And I'm like, this is some predator shit for sure. But what's happening is the Native Americans know these guys are back in their fucking territory. It's a very large expedition that are very well armed, and they're basically taking any stragglers that walk off the path, and they're getting rid of them one by one. And at some point, the Native Americans of this area feel confident enough, like, we've gotten rid of enough of them, they're not paying enough attention, and they attack. And they kill a fuck ton of people on this expedition, despite the fact that they had much better weapons. And at some point, so many of these dudes die, Jim Bridger just tells everyone, like, hey, fuck this. We're not going to find it. And if we do, we're probably going to die. The crazy dude's right. And he tells him, like, I'm going back to Fort Laramie. Fuck this. And Jim Bridger, legendary mountain man, Jim Bridger, abandons this expedition.
Wow.
And he tells him, like, you guys want to live? Follow me to Fort Laramie. Some guys decided, we're going. Like, we've already come this far. We're going on. And some of them decide, like, we're not going to go to Fort Laramie, but we're going to go somewhere else. But basically, when Jim Bridger says, like, this expedition is done, the whole thing is done with. There's some dudes who continued on to try and find the treasure. They were never seen or heard from again.
Of course they weren't.
The incoherent survivor survives. He fucking leaves with Jim Bridger. And then later on, he regains his wits enough to be like, I've lost everything. I need to find this place. And he goes to look for it, and he's never able to find it. And he starts looking through a bunch of areas that are very close. And some of these places wind up having towns nearby as this guy's life progresses. And he'll just wander into these fucking places and tell people, like, hey, the lost cabin mine is nearby. Does anyone want to help me? But at this point, it's like a legend, you know? People are like, hey, that never fucking existed. That's just, you know, some bullshit people talk about. And then he would open up this bag and be like, then where the fuck did this come from? And it's a bag filled with gold.
Shut up.
And he's like, they used to say, like, the gold was the silent witness that always corroborated this guy's story. And so people would be like, all right, like, maybe you're telling the truth, but this guy never finds the lost cabin mine, and he winds up dying too. He dies of old age and just, you know, batshit craziness. So there's variations to this story. I have found...
You can die from that? You can die from batshit craziness?
Absolutely. It leads you to stupid decisions. So there are variations to this story. I found multiple things. The one that I just told you guys is the one that I found most commonly repeated and published. And the person that published it, like, fact-checked it with, like, a bunch of historical research. The variations state that this happened, like, earlier in, like, 1853. It says, like, it was between 3 and 7 people, which is a pretty big discrepancy. It states that the Native Americans attacked before they found the vein, and they found it while they were fleeing, and then decided to build a cabin on top of the vein, mine it from inside the cabin, and then hide all of the gold that they were, like, taking in, like, a false bottom that they put into the cabin that's, like, lined with rocks and covered with 2 flat stones.
Okay.
That eventually the Native Americans found the cabin. They skedaddled, and there was, like, 2 of them that survived, just like in the other version, and they decide to go back. But when they go back, they find the cabin. When they get there, the cabin is filled with the skeletons of the people they had been on the expedition with. And that one of those 2 guys, upon discovering this, is so overwhelmed with disappointment that they didn't find the gold, and grief and fear, that he blows his fucking brains out inside the cabin.
Excuse me?
In this version, they state that the skeletons were there not because the Native Americans gathered them up and put them there, but because these dudes died trying to steal gold from Native American lands, they're cursed. And they are bound to this treasure to protect it from anyone who tries to claim it for themselves. So this treasure is not only cursed, but it has skeleton guards, which is some Legend of Zelda shit that kind of intrigues me in a weird way. So another story, and this one is apparently true, states that a group of men in the late 1800s set out to find the cabin. Because this is something people have been talking about for a long time. They're like, we're going to go find this cabin. We're going to get rich. And they wind up getting lost. And they wind up in the Cascade Mountain Ridge in Oregon. And what they do find is a massive lake known as Crater Lake, which is the deepest lake in the United States of America. It's like almost 2,000 feet deep. It's also the remnants of Mount Mazama, I think that's how you say it, which was a 12,000 foot tall volcano that erupted so fucking powerfully, it collapsed in on itself. That eruption took place 7,700 years ago, and it was supposed to have released energy 100 times that of Mount St. Helens. And we've corroborated the time frame with stories told by the Native Americans of that area that's been told for a long time of the people who lived there when that mountain exploded. And their story is about the spirit of the sky battling the spirit of the mountain, and that the catastrophe that resulted in it was because those two powerful entities were essentially trying to destroy each other, and they destroyed a massive part of the earth. And imagine what you've seen of massive volcanic eruptions. This is probably one of the largest. This actually is one of the largest. I think it's the largest explosion in the last million years on the planet. But imagine seeing that happen and the ash cloud shooting into the sky and the fucking lightning and everything that happens with the volcanic eruption, knowing absolutely nothing about volcanic eruptions. You know, you would 100% think that is the spirit of the earth trying to fight the spirit of the sky right now. There's no reason why you wouldn't think that. I mean, it would absolutely look like that. So I think it's fascinating that these Native Americans, whose gold they were trying to fucking steal, have spoken word record of a volcanic eruption that actually took place, and they find this fucking lake while looking for the gold that's still on this land. It's just like this massive coincidence. So there's a lot of folks throughout history that claim that they found the cabin, but none of them can actually ever prove it. And the cabin isn't there. There's no gold there. There's no gold mine. There's nothing that when they actually check the area shows that there was ever a vein of gold that was there. There's an article from 1908 in the Los Angeles Herald, July 7, 1908, where this super rich, wealthy family claims we found it and we're going to start prospecting it. And we're going to hire workers to go up there and mine it out. And then nothing happens with it. They just totally made it up for fucking publicity. But they it was this big headline in LA where it's hey, the lost cabin mine has been found. And it was just all bullshit. So it's just very fascinating to me that there is all this rich history with the Wild West and crazy shit that went on. And I fucking never heard of this. I've never heard of this lost cursed treasure that all these people died going for and these famous people went to try and find and never actually located it. And what it all comes down to is these dudes decided to try and make it rich, wound up on a land they shouldn't have fucking been on. They fucked around and they found out. And since then, no one's ever been able to find it. But unlike other stories like this, it's confirmed there were survivors from this party and they had a fuck ton of gold with them when they arrived. And they basically said this is all we could grab on our way out. There's a bunch more where this came from, and it's just driven people up into these mountains for the last 150 years. I'm pretty sure there's an expedition in 2016 that I was reading about where they basically stated geographically based off of the stories, legends, it's probably just a field in Oregon now that has a fuck ton of gold underneath whatever land has been tilled on top of it. But again, we'll never really know. So it really begs the question, was the treasure real? Is the treasure still out there? Is it cursed? Are there skeleton guards? I don't know. I really don't. It didn't work out very well for folks that went looking for it, though. That's all I do know.
I think by now, there's no gold. Nothing's left. I think Native Americans are smart enough to, mine that stuff themselves. I don't think they would have left anything if, they knew where it was.
Yeah, I think they would have taken it at some point when they realized hey, all of our land is disappearing. Let's go ahead and grab this shit that apparently is valuable to these fuckers that keep wandering onto our land and stealing shit from us. So it's probably not there anymore. But I'll just go ahead and say, if we get to 125 patrons, we're going to form our own explorer group. We're going to go looking for it.
It's not happening.
I think it'll be a fun time.
No.
So that, my spooky friends, is the legend of the Lost Cabin Mine.
Thanks, but it's not happening.
Robin is just such a buzzkill. She never wants to investigate any of this stuff.
Nope. You always say, like, well, once we get to 120, once we get to 120, it's like you can only do so many things once we get to 120.
That's not true. I usually make it ridiculously high amounts because I don't want to go to spooky places that are, like, overseas. It's just, like, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000. 125 seems reasonable because we live on the West Coast, and I don't think we'll find anything. I think it'll just be a fun meetup to go somewhere nearby, but it's all right. Robin doesn't want to do it, so no big deal.
No. All right, we're going to go into a commercial, and then once we get back, we're going to get into my little topic, and I'll see you there.
All right.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Hopefully you had a nice break. A little rest for your ear holes. This week, again, like I said earlier, I'm going to be doing something that is similar to what Adam covered, I think, last week even. But, yeah, if we're going by topics we've done recently, it's definitely in our wheelhouse. I know Adam covered a missing person. And so this week, I'm going to be doing a little bit of the same. I'm going to be starting my little topic series of Lost and Found. And it's just people that went missing and have been found again. The first in this series of disappearances is that of a Lawrence Joseph Bader. He was a man from Akron, Ohio, who went to, he went on quite the life-changing adventure.
Do you know of a very famous person from Akron, Ohio, who has been on a life-changing adventure?
Isn't Drew Carey supposed to be from there?
I'm pretty sure Drew Carey's from Cleveland. The person I was referring to is one LeBron James is from Akron, Ohio.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they used to call him in his very young days the Akron Hammer, which is a name that did not stick. I just wanted to bring that up.
Is the hammer his penis?
And the hammer's my penis.
All right. So, oh my gosh. If you guys have not watched Dr. Horrible Sing-Along Blog, you will not get that reference. But
you have to watch it. It's so good. It's a musical. It's on YouTube. It's Neil Patrick Harris, Nathan Fillion, and Felicia Day. Totally worth 40 minutes of your time. Fucking hilarious. Anyways.
All right. So Larry Bader was born December 2nd, 1926 in Akron. His father, Stephen, was a dentist, so I'm sure he had impeccable teeth. Though he initially wanted to follow in his father's footsteps, his grades at the University of Akron were just not conducive to that line of work. So he happened to flunk out of college after the first semester. So despite the unfortunate results of his stint in higher education, he was able to meet Mary Lou Knapp at college. And she is the woman that he married about 6 years later, on April 19th, 1952. He grew to be a typical 1950s husband. He went on to work as a cookware salesman for Lifetime Distributors. According to his coworkers and clients, they all describe him as friendly and well-liked. He was just an all-around, seemingly good guy, and he just wanted to find a way to support his family. He wanted to support Mary and the kids that she kept popping out, apparently. The job as a salesman, though, the job as a salesman just wasn't quite cutting it for him. His debts were growing, and eventually he stopped paying taxes between the years of 1951 and 1957. He just stopped paying his taxes.
Word of advice to folks, don't do that.
Yeah. So what happened in 1957, you might ask? Well, that's when things went a bit wonk. So on May 15th, 1957, Larry told Mary Lou, his wife, that he had to drive to Cleveland to go see Drew Carey, apparently. he had some business in Cleveland. So he told her he was going to leave and let her know that he had planned on going fishing afterwards and would be home late. Mary Lou was pregnant with their fourth child at the time, and understandably suggested that he come straight home instead. Larry supposedly told her, Maybe I will and maybe I won't.
I'm pretty sure I'd be murdered if I said something like that to Robin.
So he said that and left. If he actually said that, though, that's like some cold-blooded stuff right there. I can't even... Don't if you tried to say that to me, I'd be like, bitch, you get back here right this second. Like,
if I said maybe I will, maybe I won't, you would be like,
Avada Kedavra. It's known that he did indeed drive to Cleveland. It was found that he had cashed a check for $400 and paid some of his outstanding bills. One of these bills was an installment for a life insurance policy. Which is curious. He then went on to Eddie's boathouse, which was a boat rental location along the Rocky River. The Rocky River empties out into Lake Erie, which, some of you or a lot of you have probably heard of before. I even asked Adam and Jess and I was like, what is Lake Erie or where is it, you know? And they both know that it's part of the Great Lakes.
Yep.
By the time he arrived there, the proprietor of the establishment warned him that a storm was coming. But Larry is like, nah, I'll be fine. Following which, he paid the $15 deposit and asked for lights for the boat. He was then told that it wouldn't be dark for hours, so he should be fine. The owner also noticed that Larry was carrying a suitcase with him, which is also curious.
That's very curious.
Larry then proceeded to go out on the boat at approximately 4:30 p.m. So while he went out, the Coast Guard had actually spotted him and warned him as well that the storm was coming, stating that it wouldn't be safe. But at that time, the water was still calm, so it seemed like things might be okay for the time being. This was supposedly the last anyone saw of Lawrence Joseph Bader. The following morning, the boat was found washed up on Perkins Beach in Lakewood, which is located over 5 miles from the boathouse. One of the boat's propellers on the motor was bent and the hull was scratched, but that was about the extent of the damage. There was no sign that it had sank or if it had tipped or anything at any point. Only one of the two provided oars was missing. All the life jackets were still there on the boat. The gas, however, was empty, and both Bader and his mysterious suitcase were gone. Searching nearby waters didn't lead to any additional clues. The Coast Guard stated that it was impossible for anyone to survive the current without a life jacket and definitely not having been out there for hours. Search parties were created to attempt to find any sign of Larry, but after 2 months, it was decided that there was really no hope of finding him dead or alive. But he was eventually declared dead years later, I believe. Around 3 to 5 days later, after this disappearance, a man named John Johnson showed up.
What a okay. This might not be him, but if this is him, holy fuck, what a lazy name. Like, try harder, John Johnson. Mannerton.
So this guy shows up at a place called Ross's Steakhouse in Omaha, Nebraska, looking for a bartending job. So with him was a suitcase, a heavy canvas bag, and a Navy-issued driver's license. According to John, he had just gotten out of the Navy after having served for 14 years. He was supposedly discharged due to a bad back and decided to travel the country. The owner at the time of this restaurant, I believe, was called Mike Chiodo, and he decided to, like, you know what, I'll give this guy a shot, so he gave him a job.
I like the cut of his jib. He's got a good name. I trust this guy.
So while working at this steakhouse, people would comment on how strange his name was. Like, his name's freaking John Johnson. He explained that it was because he grew up in an orphanage in Boston. And so each baby was kind of given this generic name. But everyone had, you know, a unique nickname. So his nickname was Fritz. So, you know, he was John Fritz Johnson.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, it makes total sense.
The reason behind how he got his nickname would change periodically. So this, like, the story behind how he got it would be different. Sometimes it was based on a comic strip character. Other times it would be due to the haircut he got while he was in the Navy. Like, apparently there's a haircut that made him look German, and so they called him Fritz. That was one of his stories of how he got his nickname.
It's a pretty shitty origin story, unless they shaved his face down to a Hitler mustache, and that wouldn't make sense either.
Well, he preferred being called Fritz, so his checks, bills, etc., all of it was made out to Fritz. No one questioned any of this guy's curious quirks. They just knew him to be an all-around jovial dude. We also have to remember, you know, this is like a long time ago, right? We don't have as many regulations. I'm sure they could just be like, oh yeah, we'll just fill this out, for you. What name do you want on it? Yeah, we'll do that. That's fine. You know, whereas it was easier now
to get away with this shit before. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Now it's like, what's on your social security card or what's on your ID or whatever. Anyway, this Fritz guy, everyone thinks he's just some nice guy. He was into classical music. He was good at archery. He was just really, he was cool. People are just like, he's a cool dude. After his late night shifts, he would go to the local radio station, KBON, and would use their equipment and practice his broadcasting skills. His hard work would eventually pay off because in 1959, he was hired on by the station. And kind of became a little bit of a local celebrity. He would go on to perform like random stunts in order to raise money for charities. Like, this guy was nice, you know? He was kind of a local legend. He was beloved by his community. And in 1961, he met and married Nancy Zimmer, who was a former model. She had a daughter from a previous marriage, and the two had a son of their own. When they got married, he was 36 and she was 22, which is crazy. That's what, 14 years difference? That's
14. It's a good chunk of time for sure.
Yeah. After some more hard work, he went on to work at KETV, which was a local television station. So he was living quite the life. He made this whole life for himself. Big, huge career, right? In 1965, things changed. In February of 1965, he was sent to Chicago's McCormick Place to demonstrate equipment from the Sanders Archery Company of Columbus, Nebraska, as he was Nebraska State Freestyle Archery Champion at the time.
Wow, Jesus Christ, dude. So, this guy lived quite a life after he died.
While there, Suzanne Paca from Akron, Ohio, claimed that he looked just like her uncle, Larry Bader. Like, he looked like he could have been his body double. They looked so much alike. Everything except his eye patch, anyway. Because apparently, Fritz ended up with an eye patch. It just so happened that Larry Bader was also a championship archer. What are the odds? So this girl, she goes up to the booth Fritz was in and asks him, "Aren't you my Uncle Larry?" He laughs and is totally confused by the question, which is totally normal if somebody random walked up to me and was like, "Oh my gosh, aren't you my family member that blah, 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 blah?" I'd be like, "No, who the fuck are you?" You know, but he tells her his name and who he is and what he did. He was really polite and just stated like it's nothing more than a misunderstanding. So she goes on to call her family and calls Larry's brothers, who fly over, like, immediately.
So this chick's a fucking narc. She's gonna narc him out and ruin his awesome celebrity life. Yeah,
so once she told them about this crazy mystery doppelganger, they fly right over. Fritz, not understanding the potential gravity of all of this, was really cooperative. He claimed to have no idea who this Larry Bader was and agreed to be fingerprinted and all that stuff. So he goes through all this investigative, how do you do? Omaha and Chicago police both take his fingerprints and send them off to the FBI. There, they compare these to prints of Larry Bader's from his time in the actual Navy, too. Exact match. So Fritz and Larry were, in fact, the same person. despite multiple attempts by family to catch him in a lie or make it seem like this whole thing was an act, Fritz never wavered. It was like his memory had been genuinely wiped. He really had no idea about his past life. I think now would be a good time to add why he had his eye patch, because around 1964, 1965, he had actually gone to get surgery on his eye. His eye had to be removed because he had to get a cancerous tumor removed from behind that eye. So it's thought that this memory loss, this genuine memory loss, may have been due to the fact that there was a tumor in his head.
I call bullshit. The tumor didn't make him take a fucking suitcase onto a boat before he disappeared.
But it was either the boating accident or the tumor. Something caused this amnesia, but there were no definitive answers. Doctors tested him and really tried to figure it out, but they couldn't pinpoint any reason why he couldn't remember anything.
Did they x-ray like his tummy area? Because it sounds like this guy is full of shit, and I feel like that would have showed up.
Well, Fritz claimed to have 30 years of memories as this John Johnson person. If he was telling the truth about these 30 years, it could be possible that Larry had dissociative amnesia. So during, like, when you have dissociative amnesia, you kind of get into this dissociative fugue state. And during this, you get like this urge to travel and invent a whole new personality. And then when you kind of wake up from this, you've settled and you have no idea how you got there. And it has happened before to other people. Apparently, a lawyer and father of two from New York disappeared in 2005. He was found 6 months later living in a homeless shelter in Chicago, living under a brand new name. His wife revealed that he was actually, before he disappeared, he had been overcome with stress from his experiences of having been in Vietnam, and then kind of having that all brought up again by being near the World Trade Center on 9/11. So he was just like overloaded with stress and kind of snapped, I guess, and that's what happened to him. So who knows if maybe that's what happened to Larry, because he had stress over all his debts and he couldn't make ends meet. And then there's the crushing amount of taxes that he owed. Who knows? Maybe he just like one day was like, I need to get out of here, right? So what happened was Larry that day or that the week before, he went out and took a $7,000 life insurance policy with double indemnity. And he did that a week before he disappeared. Due to his lack of paying taxes, he owed $3,789, which in today's money is upwards of $30,000. So he owed a buttload in taxes. His family somehow paid that off in 1958, which was the year after he disappeared. So it's interesting timing that he took out this huge life insurance policy and then disappears, and then they pay off the taxes.
Super interesting. Yeah. It's almost like he planned it that way.
So what's also weird is when Fritz showed up at the bar in Omaha, he didn't look to be in any distress like one would look like after having sustained damage in a boating accident.
Yeah, he looked like a dude who was just like declared dead and didn't have to worry about all that bullshit from his previous life.
He was incredibly well-dressed. He seemed fine. One of the sources I read, he was even hitting on one of the waitresses.
Of course he was. What's he got to worry? He's like, hey, you want to see me shoot an arrow? I'm really fucking good at it, even though I have one
eye. But he continued living life as Fritz for about 7 years and 9 months. Then it came time for him to untangle his web, you might say. He was understandably upset when all this started happening. He was found to be married to two women at the same time. And he skipped out on years of child support for his first four children. He didn't even meet the fourth one. his first wife had been paid out $39,500 in life insurance. That is over $300,000 in today's money.
Jesus.
She was also making additional money from the Navy and Social Security every single month. A judge in Akron deemed him responsible to his first wife, and he was brought back to life on February 19th of 1966. He was an honorable man. He stayed married to his first wife and promised to find a way to support her and the kids. And when I say stayed married, I don't mean like he went back to live with her and, you know, they rekindled their relationship. I just meant like he promised that he would not divorce her. And, he was married on paper with her, but emotionally he stayed married, to Nancy. Though this second marriage was automatically voided because you can't be married to two people at the same time. So he lost his job at the TV station, went back to work as a bartender at the Ross's Steakhouse, still did his radio gigs. He was just kind of stuck in the middle. He would make $100 a week. He would send 50 to his first family and then 20 to his second family. And so that kind of left him with nothing, right? He barely had any money. So he, Nancy, his second wife, ended up having to get a job at United Airlines as a reservation clerk to help support the family. She receives 9 marriage proposals during this time from people that, saw everything happening on the news, right? He ends up living at a YMCA. He visits his second family every day. He just did not want to leave Nancy. That was his love, because he apparently didn't remember his first wife whatsoever. A bunch of sources that I read were like, it was Mary Lou kind of saying that, you know, when she met him after finding out he was alive, he was like, I don't know you. Like, I get that we're supposed to be family in some way, but like, I don't have any feelings for you. We're like strangers. And so she was like, if he's going to treat us like strangers, I'm going to treat him like a stranger. It was just all very strange.
A stranger that owes me a fuck ton of money.
He ended up having to pay all those things back. Everything, the insurance, all that. So he was just a broke ass bitch. Larry, unfortunately, was doomed to an absolutely unlucky life. A year after his life unraveled, he learned that he had terminal liver cancer.
Wow, that sucks.
So he died September 16th, 1966. That is, what, 7 months after he found out, or after he was brought back to life, he died again.
His liver was like, bet, we're gonna see.
So... he, until the day he died, was adamant that he knew nothing about his previous life. He died at 39 years old, and he kept saying that, he was Fritz. He had no knowledge of this Larry Bader person. But when he died, he was taken back to Akron, Ohio, and was buried as Lawrence Joseph Bader, which I also think is really sad, because if you honestly believe you're one person and you get buried as a different person, does your spirit just kind of wander because you don't really know who you are? You know, it's just really sad for
me.
Way
to make something that's really sad way, way sadder.
Right? But I would hope that if I were to disappear... and I'm found again, even if it's because I lost my memories and I started a new life, I just want somebody to kind of find me and let my family know that I'm not dead, right? I feel like that would be really sad if my family's just like, well, she disappeared and she died, and that's not really what happened. I just got knocked in the side of the head or something. What is that one movie? Overboard.
Wow.
Not the new one, the old one.
If you disappear, I will never stop looking for you.
So aw, never stop, never stopping.
Never stop, never stopping. And if I find you married to Kurt Russell, I'ma be pissed. I'm just saying.
But I don't know. Maybe I don't know if it's better to be left alone. Like, if they had just left him alone and let him live his life, you know, if things would have been different.
Well, yeah, things definitely would have been different, but... in cases like this, it seems very suspect that this person isn't lying. You know, everything about it seems like he prepared himself to leave his life behind. If it would have been like, he just went to get a boat, he went out, and then there was, you know, a storm that came in. That's one thing. It was like, he took out a life insurance policy before he left. He made the payment. He took a suitcase with him. Like, all this shit is very, very weird. And it just smells like someone who's trying to disappear, you know, and they have reasons to disappear. And maybe he did that, you know, at a very stressful point in his life. And like you said, something happened later where he forgot. And it definitely turns into a very sad story where he like tried to do the right thing once he was brought back to life. But it's very suspicious. I understand why if someone were to be discovered, like if I found someone that I thought was passed away, like alive, and I realized like that's the same person, I would tell people too. Like I would be like, yo, dude, I found so-and-so. He's just hanging out. Like he has an eye patch now. It's fucking weird. But it's a really sad story in the long run. It's sad for everyone involved too, not just for him and not just for the family, the first family that got abandoned, but the second one that he had after the fact and how like he didn't seem to fit in either one of them after that.
Yeah. And I think that's the hardest part, at least for me to wrap my head around, is like he couldn't be happy with one or the other. You know, he was just stuck in this limbo. But he was adamant at the end that none of it was his fault. He on his deathbed was even like, I'm Fritz, bitches. I'm not this other guy. So,
I mean, if you want people to really believe you, don't give a deathbed confession. Take that lie to the grave, because then it becomes the truth. But it really does sound like, based off of the way you told the story, at least, that, you know, it might have been him running away at first, but it just turned into him absolutely not knowing who he was after that. And it's sad. It's a very sad story.
Yeah. Welcome to Lost and Found.
Wow. The new series on Scary-ish to bring you down. So very well done, Robin. Good research on this one. I really, really liked it.
Thanks.
Right on. I think that's just about everything we have for episode 249 of Scary-ish. If you have a story you would like to share with us, it doesn't have to be about how you abandoned your first family and are hiding out secretly right now. And it doesn't have to be about an amnesiac life that you've led. But you can reach out to us about anything supernatural, spiritual, coincidental, true crime, extraterrestrial, ghostly in nature by emailing storytime@scarish.com or go to our website, scarish.com, click on contact us, fill out that form, comes directly to us, or hit us up on our social medias. Facebook is facebook.com/scarishpodcast. Twitter is @scarishpod. If we keep our Twitter, and Instagram is @scarishpodcast. Robin, for folks who would like to donate to us, how can they do so?
You can go to patreon.com/scaryishpodcast. Those are our monthly donations. Tiers that start at $1. We've been getting a couple new patrons. And just so you know, if you do join at the Badge of Honor tier and up, I'm still mailing out the art print for this season that I'm trying to catch up on. So there's that. If you're not into the monthly donation type thing, you can also go to ko-fi.com/scariespodcast. And those are one-time donations. Everything you folks share with us or support us with, whether that's talking to your family, sharing us with your friends, sharing us with strangers, we're really thankful for.
Yeah, absolutely. We appreciate all the support we get. You folks are amazing. We love seeing new folks come into the podcast and message us like, hey, I just found the show. I've been binging it. It's amazing to get those messages, and then to get messages from folks who've been listening to us for 5 years. It's awesome. And we sincerely appreciate you all. It really does keep us going. So I do think that's about everything though. So Robin, why don't you go ahead and sign us out?
Keep on creeping on, and we'll talk to you guys later.
Bye-bye.